a friend of mine from work was going to come with me. Something happened. He couldn't make it because I said, you got to come check this outdoor meeting out up here in Quakertown. And it may be the most diverse group I ever get to visit. And if you look around, just look around a little bit, we've got like all groups represented here, from just from young and old and all kinds of different looks and the whole deal. And yet, you know, I can come in here, and I've been here I don't know how many times over the years, and just feel completely at home and comfortable when I walk under this patio thing. And when I first came in, a little bit about me. I live down in the Delaware area. I also live out in central PA more than not these days. But I was a pretty sick pup. I've been sober well, in a couple weeks. It'll be 22 years since I last had a drink, if I don't drink in the next couple of weeks. And I've kind of come a long way, if you will. Some of you will identify with that, where I was when I got here. And whenever I get to go out and share with a group anywhere, I always remember the earliest days. When you were just reading the steps a few minutes ago, I can still kind of remember the first time hearing the steps read and thinking, what in the world are these people talking about? It sounded like a foreign language. It really did. And what that stuff means to me today, I just can't even put into words. But I don't have one of these. I know when you go to like speaker meetings, you get to hear these really funny, crazy stories and redemption. I don't have one of those kinds of stories. I'm sorry. It's the old joke. If I'd known I'd get to talk so much at these things, I would have done more stuff, you know, to talk about. I wasn't that kind of drunk. I'm just one of these every day. I started drinking young. I was the fifth of five boys, had two younger sisters as well. Irish Catholic on one side and Cherokee on the other. Now, just add alcohol and shake, basically, you know, with that mix. And I drank differently than my friends from day one. That's just the way my story was. I started drinking in my young teenage years and was a daily drinker, you know, through my probably junior and senior years in high school. Got in all kinds of trouble, but I just called it the consequences of partying. You know, just partying. Got to go away to school. Got thrown out of a couple of different schools. I could have probably done really well for myself, but I just couldn't get it together because of the drinking. And the consequences kept piling on and piling on. Married relatively young, had a whole bunch of kids. Well, that Catholic thing, you know, I had a whole bunch of kids in a row. I'd come home from another drunk, there'd be another little baby there. I didn't know how that was happening, and it was just really confusing. And I just kind of got led around through life. You know how that works? I had this big attitude toward the world, so I decided I'd, you know, get into a family business. And actually, we were very successful for a fairly long period of time until the drinking started turning on me. And I'm sure most everybody sitting here knows at some point you start going downhill and you're just swimming and swimming and swimming. And it seemed the further downhill I kept going, eventually the wife and the family would just get up and go. The business would collapse, and I'd find myself completely and totally alone. Drinking as much as I can around the clock. I can't really get much down anymore. I'd puke it up and I'd drink it down and just around the clock like that. I couldn't go to work. Work was interfering with my drinking. You know, you're kind of like, well, drinking or work, what do? So you quit work. And when you have your own business, that's kind of difficult to do. You just walk away from it. And that was kind of my story. And at some point in time, I decided I didn't want to live anymore. But thank God, I don't know how I guess my father-in-law had tried to 12-step me a couple of years prior. He was sober for a good period of time himself, and he came down from New York by himself to 12-step me, and he got drunk with me that night. He's been drunk since. So some of the lessons that I've learned about not going alone and some of those other things, I've kind of seen those things with my own eyes. But when it came time for me to either call it a day for life or get help, I picked up the phone. I called Alcoholics Anonymous. They sent somebody to get me. They picked me up. They put me in a detox. I don't know if you people know the Wilmington area. We have this charming place down there called Kirkwood Highway Detox, and they put me in there. It's a real, real nice place. And I took one look around, and I said, my God, I'm not like these people. You know, obviously there's been some kind of a mistake. Look at these folks. They're really sick. So I did what the only thing I could really do, if someone who wasn't sick enough to be there and they wouldn't let me out, I broke out. I literally saw a door down at the end of a hallway. I was only there 10 minutes and nobody was watching, and it had one of those panic bar things across the door. And I know they not allowed to lock those things. Somehow I cleared that enough in my head. And I sprinted down that hall and I banged through the door and all the alarms went off and I was out of there. Except there was a big fence around the outside area with this sharp stuff. I had broken into the smoking corner, okay? You're in state custody. In those days when you signed the little paper to be treated, you were actually in state custody, so they kind of had us locked in. And the white coats are chasing me and the alarms are going off, so I scurried to the top of that fence, and it was a very high fence. It's probably every bit as high as those rafters. The longer I'm sober, the higher it gets, I can tell you that much. And I climbed to the top of that fence and I leaped off the top to my freedom. Not to go get a drink or anything, just because I wasn't sick enough to belong in a place like that. And I was free. I got out. I flew off the fence. Now, the landing didn't work all that well. I was pretty sick by the time I got in there. You see, now I used to be 6'2". I don't think I'm 6'2 anymore. But I was down about 118 pounds, pretty close to malnutrition death. And when I hit the ground after jumping off that very high fence, I fractured both my legs and fractures all over, cut my hands all up, the whole thing, it was over. The running was over. I don't always talk about this. Sometimes I do, sometimes I don't. But when I fell back to the ground, something came over me, whether it was a voice on the outside or a voice on the inside, I have no idea. But that voice said, it's over. And I haven't had a desire for a drink of alcohol since that second. Now, what's that? I don't know. I don't know what caused it. I don't know where it came from. All I know is I don't ever want to lose it. I didn't even feel the pain for a little while. And then the police come and the ambulances come and they start messing with me. Then the pain hit me. So anyway, long story short, I get put into the hospital. I get put into the nut hut and eventually I get put out and put into one of these 28-day rehab things in a wheelchair. So I'm rolling around, but I've got all this stuff on my hands from the cuts, so I can't hardly push my wheelchair. I can't carry my little tray, can't get my glass of milk in the line. Those of you who have been to these rehabs, you know how it works. So they had to have my roommates and the other guys in the rehab take care of me while they were in there. They told me it was part of their therapy. You know, these were not happy guys to be taking care of me, but a few of us actually have lifelong friendships to this day. A few of them, a lot of them didn't do very well. And I got out of there, and they told me, go to AA. They said, you know, we'll prop you up, we'll feed you a little bit, we'll strengthen you up, and then you need to get to Alcoholics Anonymous. I had no clue what to expect. I started attending meetings down in Delaware, and I was only a few meetings in when I met who would become my sponsor. See, in the rehab and stuff, they told you get out of there, and then you go find and pick a sponsor. This guy came up to me and said he was going to be my sponsor. And I said, no, you don't understand how it works. I'm sober a few weeks now. And he was a bit, see, I wanted the suit and tie guy, the successful driving the Mercedes so I can hang out with him and look really, you know, really successful. And that's not at all what I got. I got a biker with the tattoos to here and metal stuff sticking out of all over the place. You know, 6'5", 240. Now I'm 6'2", 118, but I'm pretty sure I can take him. So I told him, I said, you know what, I'll take care of it. I can find my own sponsor and all. He said, no, you'll work with me. And to this day, he's moved away from the area, so I don't get to talk to him as much as I once did. But all these years later, he's still my inspiration. You know, that guy taught me how to be a sober man. He really, really did. So I embraced the program right out of the gate. I was very, very lucky. I had one of these sponsors that made it very, very clear the difference between the Fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous and the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. Made it very, very clear to me. He goes, you can rely on the fellowship alone if you'd like, but I haven't seen that be successful for a whole lot of people. But if you support yourself with the fellowship and work yourself a program over here, I think you'll get to remain comfortably sober. That feeling that we have, I'm guessing probably everybody here, when you first come, that maybe you come here all the time and it's kind of feels almost normal now. But you know that feeling when you go to a meeting, maybe you've had a bad day, maybe you've had a great day, whatever it is, and then we get here, and for that hour or so, it just feels good. You just feel like, I'll speak for myself, I feel like I belong. I feel like stuff makes sense. I feel like you guys understand me and I understand you. You know that feeling I'm talking about? I was promised that if I was to put a 12-step program in place in my life, I would not only feel that, and it's very attractive here, But I could learn how to feel it out there, at work, with my family, on the job, at the wedding, at the funeral, at the birth, at the park, on vacation. And you know what I found to be true, folks? We can. We can. But I had to do some stuff to get there. I'm fortunate that I get to work with an awful lot of young, particularly younger people these days, who come into AA. And I sponsor a bunch of guys, probably more than whatever the rules say you're supposed to. But I work with a lot of guys, and we do, you know, we get together frequently, and we do little workshop things, and we do retreats and all this fun stuff. And we get to see a lot of recovers. But we get to see a lot more not recover. And whenever I have the opportunity to stand up here in front of a room, that's what I'm always drawn to talk about. So many who come here, I've been coming to this meeting lots of time, off and on, Dave, I don't know, many, many years, and your meeting's kind of stayed the same. You know, shouldn't it be like in a stadium by now? Because a lot of new folks are coming all the time and all the time. We shouldn't be able to fit under this thing anymore with the rafters almost as high as that fence I jumped off of. We shouldn't be able to get under here anymore. For whatever reason, an awful lot of folks who come to us don't stick around. Now, we can hope that they did fine and just got about their lives, but I think we probably know for a good many that's probably not what occurred. So whenever I get a chance, I like to talk about my experience there a little bit, and maybe if there's some newer folks in this room tonight, or that, can you say this room when we're out here? Sure. This pavilion? Maybe it'll be useful. The way I was taught about this program, and the way I'm privileged to spend some time with some other guys, I have a little theory, and maybe I'm nuts. I've certainly been accused of that many times. But, you know, I have learned that the longer you're sober, the more you can get away with saying stuff. So, you know, you can. When I was brand new coming into meetings, you remember this, I'm brand new. I'm just saying the craziest, wackiest stuff, you know, ever. And you know what they always say when you're done with the crazy, wacky stuff? Keep coming back. You remember that? I don't even know I'm nuts, all right? And I'm sharing about the craziest things. And then half the room, yeah, I'd finish, and they'd say, keep coming back. And I'd be thinking, I'm impressed with these people. You know, they're impressed. Only later, when I was around a while, I realized we almost always say, keep coming back, when the craziest stuff is said in the room. So if you're new and they're saying, but you have to remember this too, there's a flip side to this. If you're sober a year or two, and every time you share, a bunch of people say, keep coming back, you're still nuts. All right, there's some work to be done. Something isn't working there. You might want to, I digress. I shouldn't go there. I get in trouble for that stuff. But I have a theory that most of the folks, I'll go out on a limb and say most of the folks who go back out, that's the phrase we use today, get drunk, whatever, pick up, whatever it is we're calling it, I'm not convinced they do so because they want to be drunk again. I'm not convinced of that. I'm convinced they do so because they can't stand being sober. I think that's what would take me back out. Knowing how bad drunk is, if sobriety is worse, I'll prefer drunk. And that's when I'm going to get in trouble one of these days if I let myself get to that point. So the key seems to be comfortable sobriety. How do I remain comfortable in life and sober at the same time? For me, in my experience, with the men I work with, a little controversial perhaps, meeting attendance doesn't achieve that. It was never designed to achieve that. Meeting attendance, along with what we mentioned in the reading, the steps as laid out in that program, that can attain that for me. I have to find a way to be comfortable out there, or I suspect at some point in time it's going to occur to me that even though I know how bad it is, drunk is going to be better than this. Well, how do you get there? How do we get comfortable? How do we get comfortable out there? It's kind of easy in here for an hour. Y'all love me. Well, at least for another 40 minutes or so. You know, we love each other. We embrace, yeah, it's great. And we hug and all these things. But then how many of us, when we're driving home, start cursing somebody right in front of us, right, as soon as we get out of this place? Because we're uncomfortable out there. And I wanted to learn how to be comfortable out there and in here. The same as I feel in here, I want to feel out there with my family, with my friends, with my coworkers. It can be done, I found out, and I'm getting better and better at it. I wish I could do it all the time. but I'm getting better and better at it. Well, how does that happen? Here's how it was told to me. You may or may not agree. But for me, the step one thing, I do not have maybe the same understanding of step one that the next person might have. So if you don't like my understanding, that's okay. But my understanding of step one is not don't drink. Isn't that weird? My understanding of step one is I will drink. That's step one for me. If I'm an alcoholic, I'm going to drink again unless something rather dramatic happens. Later, I would find out that rather dramatic happening is step two. I didn't know that yet. And I was taught step one is the step that I take based on my own experience. I'm the guy that you ever, maybe you're like this, after work, I'm just going to go out with the guys and we're going to just have a couple beers and then go home. That's the plan. Couple drinks, home. We go out, we go to the bar, we've had a couple of drinks, and one by one, the other guys, they go home. I'm still there. I'm waiting for new guys to replace them. Other guys like me. I can seek a lower and lower companion. They have sufficient reason to go home and get on out of here. My body, my mind, whatever it is telling me, give me some more. That wasn't even my intention. They know, you know, and you know what they say to us, because I'll say to them, where are you going? We just had a couple. Oh, I got to work tomorrow. We're like, what does that have to do? We're drinking here, you know? I got to pick up the kids. No. You know? I'm driving. I love that one. What does that have to do with anything? See, they have good reasons, sufficient reasons. They believe their reasons and they leave. They believe those things to be true. They got to pick up the kids. They got to go to work. All those things win. Off they go. I'm still there. One more. That always wins with me. I learned this about me. If you're alcoholic, maybe you agree. When I put some booze into my body says, keep it coming. Keep them coming. I never knew that. I mean, I always knew I drank like that, but I just thought I was, you know, I was just a no good, good for nothing worker, father, husband, friend. That's what everybody always told me. It turns out when you put alcohol on an alcoholic like me, my body says, give me a few more. Keep them coming. Those guys, they get, what you've heard it described probably, they get that out of control feeling and they want to go home and go to bed. Anyone in here feel that way? No. We get an in control feeling and we want to go to Las Vegas, right? I mean, that's really, it's different. Something's very, very different about the alcoholic in me physically. And then I have this thing, my sponsor, I didn't understand it. They called it an obsession. I have this obsession of the mind. They always talk about that in step one and all the literature. Obsession, I didn't know what it meant. He described it pretty good for me. He said, an obsession is a thought so powerful, usually false, that it overrides all thoughts to the contrary. What are the thoughts to the contrary? Got to work tomorrow. I'm driving. I got to pick up the kids. I have those things too in my life, but they don't win. With me, the drink wins. The drink wins. The obsession to have another and another and another and another. So when I'm drinking, I got to keep drinking. I bet some of you guys are like that. When I'm drinking, I got to keep them coming. And when I stop for any reason, I didn't do a lot of stopping, but every now and again, I could stop for a little while. I always resume drinking. So if you got to drink when you're drinking, and you always resume drinking when you're not drinking, you're powerless over alcohol. I understood what they meant. I didn't really get it until they explained it that way. In other words, you know what they told me basically? I'm screwed. I got to drink when I'm drinking. I'm going to drink when I'm not drinking. That's powerless over alcohol. I didn't understand the second part either. They said this thing about unmanageability. Again, it's based on my own experience. I didn't understand. I knew I did like stupid stuff. But everybody does stupid stuff to varying degrees. And I wasn't really sure, you know, when I get drunk, yeah, everybody does dumb stuff when they're drunk. My sponsor explained, no, that's not what we're talking about, this unmanageability. He said, unmanageability to him, and it makes sense to me, and to a lot of the men I work with today, is when I'm running around believing things that aren't true. I have a different version of the truth than non-alcoholic people seem to have. And I found out, think about this, if you're running around in life making life's decisions based on stuff that isn't true, life's going to be unmanageable. How could it not be unmanageable? So I got a little thinking problem and I got a drinking problem. I'm screwed. I got a body that can't drink and a mind that swears that it can. What am I going to do with that? So step one, as I was told, was not don't drink, go to a meeting, whatever it is they say today. Step one for me is I will drink. And it's a good thing that's the way it was presented to me. You know, if step one is presented to us in that fashion and we know we're screwed, step two suddenly looks a lot more interesting, doesn't it? A lot more interesting. Now I recognize, going to a meeting every day is not going to get me unscrewed. Going to a meeting every day and maybe looking at some more steps might. That might work. So I was taught, we take step one based on our own experience. Hey, we take step two, if you're new, based on the other guy's experience. We take step two based on your experience. I don't have it yet. I have step one experience. I don't have step two experience. I have to come around, listen to you guys, hang out. I feel good. I feel understood. You understand me. I feel like I'm home. I belong. And listen to your stories and how you've changed and how you've held off. You were screwed once too and you're not drinking anymore. And come to believe that maybe that can happen for me too. Based on your experience, not mine. I don't have any. Very, very different way of looking at it when it was presented to me that way. Number one, I'm screwed. You guys used to be your unscrewed. And then I literally got told, choose. Which way do you want to do it? Keep doing it your way, your experience? Stay screwed? Or do it with our experience? You don't have any of this kind, but try it our way. Step two, get unscrewed. Find a way out of this mess. We did. Pretty attractive. And I was taught step three is very little more than deciding between those two. Make a decision. What do you want to do? Which way do you want to go? I didn't understand. Now I do. Makes perfect sense now. Make a decision between step one and step two. Make a decision between my experience and your experience. Yours is pretty powerful. There's a lot of you here. It's just me and my own little world by the time I got here. I had nothing going anymore. It wasn't all that difficult. I've heard from many people it is a difficult decision. I understand why, too. And then it says, make a decision. Then they made a mistake, I think. They put the rest of the step in there. And that throws us all off. To turn my will over to what? You know, I'd left the church. I'd left God. If there was a God, I sure hope he didn't know where I was. I'm pretty sure there's so many Catholics, he loses track of a lot of us. All right, I'm kind of hoping that that may be the case. I don't want anything to do with God. I don't want to do anything. I was told, relax. I hear that all the time. I hear people say all the time, you ever hear this? I don't get the spiritual part of the program. I get the thing, but I don't get the spiritual part. You ever heard that? Is there any other part? Is there really any other part to AA than the spiritual part? I heard this, try that. If you're curious about the spiritual part, next time you go to your meeting and you're chairing, make your topic non-spiritual parts of AA. That's about how quiet it'll be in the room. What are we going to talk about? Okay, folks, just talk about the non-spiritual part. There aren't any. So we can't, if we're grasping the program, I don't think there's a spiritual part I can miss. I think it's the concept of it I must be missing. And I did for some time. But here's what I like about this whole turning will over and God and all that. So I didn't want anything to do with it. But I was taught a little bit differently. If we went around the room right now, we'll start with Dave over there. And if we... I don't really want to start with you, Dave. I know you'll stand up and take all my time. But if we start with Dave and we say, go around the room and everybody tell your story, would we not have, how many people here? 100 people. Wouldn't we not have 100 different stories, right? It'd be chaos. There'd be no understanding at all. But if I went around the room starting with Dave and just said, give me a one-word answer that describes a characteristic of your life drinking. He would throw a word out there, right? And then Ron, right, would throw a word out there, and on and on and on. We wouldn't be to the second table when we'd be repeating the same words. We'd have total agreement. We'd probably hear anger, scared, lonely, guilty, ashamed, all these different things, these ugly, ugly things that we lived out there. And by the time we got around to partly through the table, we'd all be thinking, oh, my God, it's my turn. I can't think of it. It'd be the same words. We'd have commonality real fast, right? Nobody argues that. If we went around the room, starting with Dave, and we said, describe your God, he would get up and he would give us his version of God, and Ram would give us his version of God, and on, and we would have 100 different versions of God, and they would be all over the place, would they not? But if I went to them and say, no, just give me a word, a characteristic of God, we wouldn't get to the second table. We'd be repeating the same words again, would we not? We'd be saying loving, compassionate, I don't know, tolerant, patient, supportive, all these words that no matter what understanding of God we might have, we will find we all describe God, spirit, divine, whatever, with the same words all the time, no matter where we go in the world. Fascinating. We don't have to worry that we have 100 different versions of God. It doesn't have anything to do with it. We have the exact same characteristics of God. And by the time we got to the second table, we would probably all be in agreement, would we not? I've learned that 12-step recovery, for me, has been going from the characteristics that we all have in common describing my drinking life to somehow becoming the characteristics that we all describe as belonging to God. Going from one to the other. Well, how do you do that? That's what the steps are for. Which person is going to be more comfortable in sobriety? The guy that lives by the old way, the anger, the fear, the scare, the guilt, the shame. Can that guy stay sober? I don't know. I think that guy's sobriety is going to be more uncomfortable than drinking. Even though he knows how bad drinking is, I think he'll go back. But how about the guy that tries to live day by day as best he can by those God-like kind of qualities? And he's living in a loving, tolerant, patient, supportive, helpful kind of fashion. How's that guy going to do? I would think much better. I would think an awful lot better. And I was told if I could make that transition, then I could successfully recover from alcoholism. Somewhere in the big book, I'm a student of the book. I'm not one of these thumper kind of guys. Well, yeah, I am. I don't believe the big book is something that floated down on on an angel's shoulders and all. It was the collective experience of the early members based on a ton of history. I love to study it. Those of you who know me, I have a library of all this stuff. It's crazy. I have a little trouble doing things in moderation. So my library, I literally have 7,000-8,000 volumes now. Half my house is just AA stuff. It's ridiculous. But I have a daughter. She's sober. For you younger folks, she got sober at 22. She'll be celebrating 10 years in a few months, 10 years continuous. So you young folks, obviously it's there for you as well. But when I start talking this history stuff, she's like, all right, just leave. You know, she wants nothing to do with that stuff. She just wants to work a program, be comfortable. She married a guy in recovery. He's sober 2 or 3 years less than her. He's a wonderful, wonderful guy. Now I have a grandchild that I actually kind of can keep track of and stuff. I mean, do all the dad stuff. I missed all that stuff. My kids were a little bit older by the time I sobered up, so I missed all that. I get to do that again. She's sober. I have a son, some of you know, who's homeless living in his car and wants nothing to do with us, anything to do with us. What we have doesn't work. He lives in his car, okay? I just came from my vacation home. I think it works. All right, but no, he's just turned off to it. So I've seen it from all different angles. But when I go and I look at the way our program was kind of developed, there's some phrasing in there that I think it gets lost. I wish we talked about it more. But there's one particular part of the book where it's this doctor is treating this alcoholic before AA even happened. This Carl Jung guy. You heard of this guy? All right, some say Carl Jung. Some say Carl Jung. I say Carl Jung because I think it makes me sound smarter when I say it that way. But he's treating this alcoholic and he's saying, what I've been trying to do for you is your life is driven by these ideas, emotions, and attitudes. That's the phrases he used. The ideas, emotions, and attitudes that are the guiding force of your life. I'm trying to change all them around on you. If I can do that, you can get better. That's exactly what we just talked about. If we go around the room, the ideas, emotions, and attitudes that were the guiding forces in our life before, anger, hate, shame, all those things, switched for the ideas, emotions, and attitudes guided by loving, tolerant, supportive, all these nice things, these God-like qualities, if you would. So they talked about it even before there was an AA. We got to flip-flop somehow. We have to change. I work in a company now. I really love my work. And I actually left the company for a while and got rehired to come in to change the company. Now, you know how much fun it is when you get to be the guy to walk in the door and tell all the employees, I'm here to change the company. You know, they really like that sort of thing. And I have had to make a lot of changes. Our company's at this point that it's really starting to go crazy. It's really growing. And some folks are just kind of like so stuck in the way they do things that they don't want to change I've been that person. I've been the person trying to change it, and I've been the person trying to hold on to it. The consequences, this one particular segment of my company, the consequences have been bad. My company's doing this. Their segment's doing this. The consequences have been horrible. They're doing things wrongly to succeed in business. And I've tried and tried and tried to get them to change, and they will not let go of the old ways. So I had to sit them down. I don't like doing this stuff, but I had to sit them down, and I said to the leadership group, I said, guys, here we are. It's I keep saying guys because in this group it's all men. I work in the construction business and construction equipment business, and I know this is hard for you, some of you, to accept, but in the construction business there's some drinking going on sometimes, a little bit of alcoholism floating around. But I had to get these guys in the room. All the consequences in the world would not make them change, no matter what I tried to do. So I had to sit them down and say, here's the deal. If you don't change, I change you. I have to. For the rest of the time. I'm not doing it to you. I'm doing it for all them. You have to. We have to change this segment. And now they're a little more open because I took consequences and I slammed them with circumstances. Now they got circumstances and consequences. The consequences are already there, but the circumstances are, folks, you don't change, you're not going to have a job with this company. You'll have to move on to another company. I think step one and our steps kind of look like the same way. Isn't it funny? Did consequences drive? Consequences didn't drive me to have the willingness. Some circumstances at the very end is what drove me over the, you know, losing my home, losing my position, all those, losing my kids, losing my family. None of that stopped me from drinking. Losing my brother drank himself to death at an early age. Another brother drunk himself permanently into the nut hut at an early age. That stopped me? Nope. But suddenly circumstances dictated that change was necessary and something opened up in me and you guys were there to show me what those changes are. I think that's what we have to do here. And this whole idea for me, if you're newer, this idea that I'm screwed over here, there's a way out over here, and I have to decide, and that there's a way to get there, but then we muddy it all up with this God talk. And that chases a lot of us out of here. Maybe it's because, I shouldn't say this either, but there are many of us in the program who quite with good intention want to take our definition of God and stick it on the next person. Hey, this one works. This is right. Stick it on you. Embrace it and everything will be fine. And we don't want anything to do with it. My own sponsor in the beginning was kind of, here's my God. This is the way it's going to have to work for you. And I was like, no, I'm not going there. Now I found a very comfortable God sense that works for me. But sometimes maybe we might push that a little bit wrongly, but that's just me standing up here. But what if we just kind of looked at it, at least in the beginning when you're newer, of this idea that there may be a set of characteristics, God-like characteristics to aspire to, and maybe there is something floating around out there to guide us, ideas, emotions, and attitudes that can be a guiding force in our life. What do I mean by that? I heard this from a guy way back when, and I like to repeat it when I get a chance. You might think it's off the wall, but I don't. We're trying to get to what is it they say in the latter steps? A conscious contact with this God thing? A conscious contact with these characteristics, if you will, to live by? Has this ever happened to you guys? You're about to do something, about to take an action of some sort, and out of nowhere, like a little voice comes up and says, don't do it. Don't do it. You ever had that happen? A lot of you are nodding. Or you've already done it, whatever it is, and somewhere something says back here, now why did you do that? Have you ever had that? You know, I have asked every single person, this is what I taught. I must be the worst person to hang around in. You know, I just meet you. Hi, I'm an AA. How are you? You know, but I ask everybody I meet, have you ever experienced that, whatever that is, that thing that says, don't do it? What is that? I firmly believe that that is an unconscious contact with God. I think that's what it's guidance. You notice it never says this, you're about to do something. The voice never says, go rob the gas station. It never says that. It's always like a good thing, you know? Oh, don't treat them that way. Or could you go over there and help that poor woman? It never says, punch the boss and leave. It doesn't. That's not the guidance I get. What if that's an unconscious contact with God? I have asked literally, guys, ask everyone you know. I've yet to find a human being that has said, no, I've never experienced that. What they will say is this. Well, yeah, kind of now and then. It's not predictable. It just kind of happens type of thing. So I always ask them, why do you think that is? And I'll say, I get it a fair amount now. And they'll say, no, not me. It just pops up now and again. And I say to them, well, what if that little guiding, loving, compassionate, tolerant, supportive little voice was always there? Wouldn't that be nice? And of course, they always say, well, yeah, I could live with that kind of guidance. That would be all right. But it isn't always there. And I say, well, why not? I get it a lot. And they say, no, I only get it every once in a while. And I'll say to the new person, why? It's there. It's there for everybody. Why don't you get it much? And inevitably, they will get to the point where they're going to say something like, I don't know, I'm blocked off from it. Something's blocking it. I don't get it. And then we can sit them down and say, exactly. Something's blocking it. It's there for all of us. It's like a radio station. A radio station sends a signal up in the air, and we can all turn in our different individual radios with knobs and tuners and all these things. And according to how good the device is and how good we work the tools, it's how good we get the signal. But it's there. It's a perfect signal. It's there for everybody. The same thing seems to be true with this guidance, but what's blocking it? And they always say, well, I guess we're blocked. And they say, well, how do I get unblocked? And I like it when they say something like that, because then we can say, well, that's what the fourth step's for. That's what the fourth step was for. That's what I was told. The fourth step is so I can get an inventory down on a piece of paper of what's blocking me from new ideas, emotions, and attitudes that are trying to guide my life, and I won't let them. That's what the inventory. Man, I thought the inventory was this big, scary, write all this ugly stuff down kind of thing. I had it all wrong. You ever hear that in your meetings? Oh, wait till you get there. You ever hear that? Wait till you get to the fourth step. That's a scary one. But then later in the 6 and 7, that's when they say separates the men from the boys and the women. Is that the right step? They say that? I think that's a more difficult step, 6 and 7. Fourth step, not that hard. We sit down and we do it. So I get to sit with the guys and we kind of write that out and we go to a fifth step. And my sponsor talked this stuff over with me. At least we identified, just like I did with the guys at work, the stuff that isn't working. The ideas and emotions and attitudes that weren't working before. Kind of hard to deny it once you get it down on a piece of paper. And now I think I'm starting my transition to getting over to those characteristics that I'd like to live by and leave the old ones behind. So my sponsor and I talked it through in a fifth step. Maybe a little different than you've heard of the fifth step described. That's how it's worked for us. And then 6 and 7, that's the key for me. That's the program for me, 6 and 7 step. That was a biggie. Man, they got whole books on those things, you know. But you look in the big book and there's like 2 sentences. So it looks like it doesn't mean anything. Oh, this is an easy one. I've done that. But, you know, it was after a while I finally figured out those 2 little sentences are summaries. They're summary paragraphs of everything that happened in that book all the way back to the very beginning. Took me a while to figure that one out. It's summarizing. Okay, you got all this info. What are you going to do with it now? It's really what I'm asking. It's asking us to do. And now I get to change. I start changing so that I can be comfortable and sober at the same time. Kind of like, and then you'll hear, I was one of these guys that, you ever hear this? Well, I got to have some balance in my life. Got to have balance. I don't have balance. So we don't have balance. Got to add more meetings. Take away some meetings. Got to add more time to the kids. Take away to that. Got to have another job. 2 jobs. 4 jobs. Oh, more meetings. Got to go over there. And we're trying. You ever notice that we try to balance? And it suddenly occurred to me, guys, I was trying to balance recovery and life. They're not 2 things. You can't balance recovery in life. I found out. I tried. I failed miserably. You can't. How are you going to balance one? They're the same thing. Here's what I was taught. If you're newer, think of it this way. Throw out the balance thing. Oh, Jesus, a lot of sponsors are going to be mad at me. Just throw the whole balance thing out. Don't balance. Blend. Blend it. It's only 1 thing. Everything is 1 thing that we do around here. Everything spiritual that we do around here. We do the exact same thing in this pavilion as we do when we drive home tonight. I got a 60-something mile drive home tonight. How am I going to treat the other folks on the road? You know? You ever get a tailgater behind you? Anybody in here? It's probably not. It probably doesn't happen in Quakertown. Everyone's calm around here. You ever get the tailgater and the tailgater becomes a guiding force in your life? Don't laugh, right? You're driving, and you look in your rearview mirror, and there's the car right up on top of you, right? And you look in your mirror, here's what you see, right? That's all you say. I don't know how they do that. My son's 6'5". And when he drives, all you see is his cap and his fist up here like that, doing it. And do they not decide how we drive? Come on. Who's around here? Hits the brakes, right? Slows down, speeds up. We'll go past our exit or our street or our stop sign just to mess with the guy. And the 16-year-old kid who got his license 48 hours ago is now determining how we drive. He's determining our mood. He's determining our attitude. Probably our attitude. Are you like me? You go home. You go inside. Damn kids today. Tell your wife. Tell your husband. Tell everybody. I was followed home by the... It ruins my whole day. From some kid following me. And you know what? He wasn't tailgating me. He's driving too close to the car in front of him. It had nothing to do with me until I made it about me. Until I made him a guiding force in my life. What happens when you get out of his way? You know what he does? Speeds up to the next car, doesn't he? Doesn't have anything to do with that driver either. Has nothing to do with me at all until I make it about me. It's amazing how guiding forces can take over my life that quick. At work, my boss, when I allow other people to define me. This program promises that if we can find a way to transition from those old characteristics of life, the old ideas, things we believe to be true that caused unmanageability in our lives, to the truth or God-like qualities in our life and try to live that way on a daily basis, then we don't get uncomfortable like that. We don't give our life over to some 16-year-old kid who's not even following me. He's following the car in front of him too close. We blend it. What if that great feeling we have in here you could have when you go to work tomorrow? Why do we look at each other in here and subscribe or prescribe different characteristics to us in here than we do to folks out there? They're just like us. Maybe not as sick. You know, maybe when the boss talks to us, we should say, thanks, keep coming back. Yeah, you could try it. Why is that? I used to think it was them. I realize it's me. It's where I am today. What characteristics do I live in? It's like going to the shopping mall. Anybody goes to the shopping mall Christmas time? When I go to the shopping mall Christmas time, I always park in the wrong part of the parking lot. And the store I need is like way over there. So you got to walk like 4 miles. And as soon as it's like there's an alert. As soon as I walk in, the lady with the triple stroller comes out from somewhere with the three kids. You seen this lady? Did she get in front of you as well? And you're not going 12 feet with that when one of the kids drops the bottle or the thing in its mouth or its booty. And the whole place just comes to a crashing halt and she's in my way. I can't get to where I got to get. That's because it's all about me that particular day. I can go to the mall the next day. They open the smoky door. The lady with the triple stroller comes out. She's right in front of me and I just breeze around her like it's nothing. Just have a good old time. Just floating around. It's me. It's my perception. It's the characteristics I'm choosing to live in that given moment. Step 6 and 7, that to me, that's the big deal. That's what I get to decide. That's where I get to decide that what kind of program do I want. Do I just want a program where I'm going to put some barriers between me and alcohol? Just not drink. Put some barriers up there and do everything I can do to stay away from alcohol. Stay away from it. That's uncomfortable sobriety in my book. Or am I going to practice principles in my life and characteristics in my life that allow me to grow away from alcohol? That's the 7th step. Grow into somebody entirely different. Alcohol is not even significant anymore. It's not a guiding force in my life anymore. I don't hang around it. I don't want to hang around with a bunch of sloppy drunks. I don't want anything to do with any of that stuff anymore. But it doesn't drive me like it once did, nor do other things. Now that I've tried, I get better at it all the time, but sometimes I slip back really, really quick. And in the 6th and 7th step, that's where I'm asked to decide, which way am I going? Do I want to go just stay away from it, or do I work towards something, a whole new idea, a whole new way of living? And I'm telling you guys, I was telling Dave before the meeting, nobody promises that we can come in here, hit the lottery, meet the right woman, meet the right guy, you know, marry, all these. But things can happen. I've seen it happen. Amazing things can happen. And I've seen people come in and recover whose lives stayed tough. Stayed tough. Didn't have a lot of money or a lot of this or, you know, had a lot of loss or whatever. And yet, they're the most remarkable people you'd ever want to meet. They seem to have incredibly comfortable sobriety. Those folks, I don't think they're the ones that end up going back to drinking. I don't think those are the people. And the eighth and ninth step, just real quick, you know, I had a lot of guilt, a lot of shame. When I came in here, I'd done a lot of things. I'd hurt a lot of people, hurt a lot of families, put a lot of people out of, you know, they worked for me. I had a few hundred employees, and everybody went when I went. You know, people lost homes. It was bad. And I was very, very ashamed, very embarrassed, and I had to work hard. Some of you know me well. It was literally, I think it was just after my 20th anniversary sober that I finished paying my financial amends. It took over 20 years to do it. But every stinking dollar, I got a little bit closer to the ideal I was working toward. I know today in AA, it is a big movement of, you know, self-forgiveness. I tried self-forgiveness. Have you tried self-forgiveness? I mean, it sure looked convenient. I mean, I like the idea of it. Just skip all that amends and everything. But it didn't. I stole some money from an aunt. I'll tell the story very, very fast. My aunt Doris. I stole some money. My brother got blamed, which if you're going to steal, that's kind of a nice thing to happen right behind it, you know. So my brother, all these years looked at as a thief. I'm looked at as, you know, a nice, innocent little guy that didn't steal the money. Obviously, many years later, I had to make the amend. And, you know, here I am with the money I stole out of my aunt's purse, and I wanted to make it right. Now, self-forgiveness, I suppose, would say, I could go to my aunt and call her up and say, Aunt Doris, this is Dan. Do you remember many, many years ago when you thought my brother stole the money out of your purse and it really ruined our family and just created chasms all over at weddings and everybody was tense all these years? And I feel so bad. I stole the money. But don't worry about it because I forgive myself. Now, it doesn't have the same ring, you know, as when I go to her and say, it was me. Here's your 20 bucks. And I go to my brother. It was me. I apologize. I'm going to write a letter to the whole family. I'm going to put up a billboard. Whatever I got to do, everybody knows I'm the guy. And then I can go to the family weddings and hold my head up and feel pretty good. And then the 10th step, all I try to do when I look at the 10th step, guys, is I just continue to try to see where I am on the old side versus the new side. Just keep building on it and building on it and building on it. Now that little voice that said, don't do that, now I can stop and get quiet. And I can say, what should I do? I wonder if I should do this. And my voice was very quiet. I say, don't do that. Do this instead. Or should I do this? And I can wait, be quiet. I will say this, if you're like me, I sometimes say the wrong thing. Not tonight. I liked everything I said tonight. But I sometimes say the wrong thing. And if you're early in sobriety, you ever notice you can't take words back? I mean, once they're out there, it's not like a cartoon where you can get that thing and pull it back in again. And you can't. But let me tell you, if you're newer, it's okay. You need to know that for every year of recovery, you get one more second of response time. It's true. It's something happens. I don't know how to explain it, but it's true. So if you're like brand new and somebody says, get out of my way, you're going to right away say, get out of my way. But if you're like 5 years sober and somebody says, get out of my way, you're going to be, I apologize, let me move. 1 minute, 1 second for every year of recovery. Please remember that. It's very, very important. So we get into, I don't know, any idea where that one came from, Dave. I met some strange people in AA along the way. Guys, really, we get into the 11th and the 12th step. Of course, we just try to deepen this thing. We get opportunities like this. We get out here and talk about this thing. I can absolutely guarantee anybody in the room, should you choose 12-step recovery, make no mistake, we have to choose it. We have to choose it. I've lost so many folks who chose not to participate in our recovery. Once we're here, if we really want to leave the drinking behind, and our goal is to have sobriety that's every bit as comfortable out there as when we wander in here, please consider, put a 12-step program in your life. Take full advantage of the fellowship. Work the steps through to the best of your ability. And we try to live that way every day. And I can guarantee you this, we will not have to take a drink today. We will have what it says in the back of the book, a profound alteration in our reaction to life. I've had a spiritual experience, what they describe in the back. We don't say that in meetings too much because everybody, I've had a spiritual experience. Well, listen to that arrogant guy, right? We don't say it out loud. I don't know why. It's the prize. It's the prize. We can be every bit as comfortable out there as we are in here. Thanks for listening.